Good morning. May it please the court, Casey Granis on behalf of Charles Bluford. I'll reserve 4 minutes.
4 minutes, okay.
This is a three strikes case. Mr. Bluford challenges his convictions as well as his life sentence. I'd like to first turn to the sentencing issues in this case. The trial court sentenced Mr. Bluford to life without the possibility of release. Based on its ruling that Mr. Bluford's prior robbery offenses from New Jersey and South Carolina qualified as comparable to Washington most serious offenses. That was wrong. And to explain why it was wrong, I'll first turn to the New Jersey robbery at issue here. That's not comparable. It's not legally comparable for two reasons. First reason is that we don't have the charging document in the record to which Mr. Bluford pled guilty. That's a problem because under New Jersey, there are different ways of committing robbery, second-degree robbery to which he pled guilty. One of those ways is indisputably broader than what Washington recognizes as a robbery, and that's has to do with the prong of committing or threatening immediately to commit any crime in the first or second degree. That's the New Jersey prong. That's one of the prongs in the New Jersey statute. Now, if we had the charging document and the record to which he pled guilty, we'd know which prong he pled guilty to, but we don't. So the state has failed in its burden to prove comparability to the New Jersey robbery for that reason alone. There's a second and independent reason why the New Jersey offense is broader. Legally broader than a Washington robbery offense. And it's that in New Jersey, a completed offense of robbery can include the attempted taking or the attempted theft. That's broader than the completed offense of Washington robbery. There's no doubt about that. The state, however, argues, well, if that's the case, even so, then that means that Mr. Bluford could have merely committed what's comparable to an attempted robbery in Washington, which is still a most serious offense. The problem with that is the differing mens reas at issue in New Jersey to be found guilty of the completed robbery just based on attempted theft. You still have to prove that the attempted theft was done with force or threat of force, and the mens rea attached to that under New Jersey law is simple knowledge, whereas if we're going to try to compare that to the attempted robbery offense in Washington, we've got a situation where you have to prove the intent to commit the specific crime of attempted robbery. That means the intent to take property by means of force. So again, we've got a broader mens rea for the New Jersey offense than under the Washington attempted robbery offense. Now, there's no dispute that factual comparability isn't met here, and for that reason alone, the life sentence needs to be reversed because the New Jersey offense isn't comparable. Now, turning to the South Carolina robberies, there are two of them. But they were convictions, both pleaded guilty on the same day, convictions entered the same day. So functionally, they're considered as one. But that those South Carolina robbery convictions aren't comparable to Washington most serious offense either. And for that proposition, I rely on the South Carolina case of State v. Hyman, where the court held, or rather, well, back up a second, the defendant in that case argued that in order to constitute robbery, that the intent to steal needed to occur simultaneously with the taking of the property. And the South Carolina Supreme Court said no, the intent to steal need not be present at the time the property is obtained. And that's broader than Washington law on robbery, where Washington law says that at the time of the taking of the property, the intent to steal must be present. And that's under whether the, that's under all scenarios, a transactional theory of robbery, that proposition holds, or if the initial taking is taken, if the initial taking is used by means of force, then that proposition still holds. But the South Carolina law is broader than that. In fact, the South Carolina case of Hyman doesn't talk about transactional theory of robbery at all, although that analogous doctrine exists in South Carolina law. Rather, there's this broad statement that the intent to steal need not exist at the time of obtaining possession. And for that reason, the South Carolina robbery is not legally comparable to the Washington offense of robbery. And again, just as with the New Jersey robbery, there's no dispute on appeal that the factual comparability isn't met on this record. And for those reasons, the life sentence should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Stephanie Guthrie, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County on behalf of the State of Washington. I intend to address the comparability issues very briefly, particularly the New Jersey robbery, and then turn to the joinder issue unless the court has questions on another issue.
You better cover the South Carolina as well.
I will. Thank you. The New Jersey, this court should hold that the trial court properly held that the state had proved comparability of the New Jersey robbery by a preponderance of the evidence, which is the standard, because the record as a whole shows that the defendant more likely than not pled guilty under the same prong under which he was originally indicted. We know that the defense does not dispute that the prong under which he was originally indicted is comparable to a Washington robbery. The amendment down to robbery in the second degree merely removed the deadly weapon allegation. The deadly weapon allegation. There is no amended charging document as far as we can tell. But what that tells us is that the most likely scenario under which an amended charging document would not be necessary, and perhaps the only scenario under which it would not be necessary, is when the only change is that necessary in dropping down the degree, removing that deadly weapon allegation, holding the element.
How do we know that it wasn't necessary as opposed to you just didn't find it?
We have the certification from New Jersey that they gave us the complete record, and nowhere attached to that is an amended charging document. Nowhere in the documents, in the paperwork, the statement of defendant on plea of guilty, is there a reference to an amended charging document suggesting that one exists. And nowhere in those documents is any indication that the prong changed. And we also have the trial court's comments. Now, while it's not proper to use unproven facts to do a factual comparability analysis, it is proper to look at the record as a whole to determine either what facts to which the defendant did stipulate, or in this case, to determine under which prong the defendant pled guilty. So we're merely looking at the record as a whole. And so, you know, if the trial court's judgment had said, I note that the defendant stipulated to the certification for determination of probable cause, that would be evidence that the defendant had, in fact, stipulated to those facts. Here we have the trial court noting that this involved a case of a theft with what appeared to be what was not actually a deadly weapon, which explains the amendment down. So given all of that, it is far more likely than not that the defendant pled guilty under the same prong originally indicted, and there's no basis to conclude that he more likely than not pled under some new prong that was never mentioned with no apparent tie to the facts of the case. Furthermore, the fact that a New Jersey completed robbery can include an attempted theft is not a problem here. A New Jersey completed robbery is, even under the attempted theft option, would be identical to a Washington robbery or comparable to a Washington robbery in every element except the fact that the theft was not completed. So the force, we don't have to worry about the mens rea as to the force because the force was completed in both cases. We have actual force used in a New Jersey robbery being comparable to actual force used in a Washington robbery. The only thing that's missing in the New Jersey robbery would be the actual completion of the theft. So clearly under Washington law, you would need intent to complete the theft in order to have an attempted robbery. But here we have that because New Jersey requires attempt to steal, attempted theft in their own robbery statute, which requires purposeful, intentional behavior. Not every Washington attempted robbery is a New Jersey completed robbery, but every New Jersey completed robbery is a Washington, is at the very least a Washington attempted robbery. The South Carolina robberies are also legally comparable. The defendant seems to be completely ignoring the fact that Washington has, as an element, as a method of committing theft, exerting unauthorized control, which is by its very nature the initial obtaining properly and then later forming the intent to appropriate that to your own use. The cases cited all trace back to cases about the old Washington theft statute that actually had separate subsections for what is now our unlawfully obtains and our exerts unauthorized control provisions. So just like the South Carolina cases trace back to situations like a defendant who borrows a gun and then appropriates it to his own use and never gives it back, in Washington, borrowing something and then appropriating it to your own use and forming the intent to steal it is also theft. So there is no difference in Washington and South Carolina law on that point. Both encompass an initial unlawful obtaining with intent and as well as the initial proper obtaining with a subsequent unlawful taking and unlawful intent to appropriate to one's own use. And there simply is no difference between the two states there, and therefore the South Carolina robberies are also comparable. Turning to the joinder issue, we ask this court to take the opportunity to clarify the case law and abrogate or overrule Bryant because it does improperly import CRR 4.4 severance analysis into the question of propriety of initial joinder under 4.3.
The Court of Appeals doesn't overrule prior Court of Appeals decisions.
We ask the court to abandon Bryant as not consistent with other controlling case law, such as Bithrow and Markle and Russell, all of which make clear that the initial joinder is proper so long as CRR 4.3 is satisfied, but that if that proper joinder is unduly prejudicial, that then becomes an issue for severance. I would note, contrary to the defendant's reply brief, these cases do not address prejudice as a part of the joinder analysis. They address it as part of a severance analysis. Thompson was a severance case, even though inexplicably the court cited to 4.3 instead of 4.4. They very clearly said this was about the denial of a motion to sever. Smith, which was cited extensively in the prior brief, is a case that predates the criminal rules. At that point, there was not this very clear distinction of joinder asks how similarly connected are the charges and severance asks is the defendant prejudiced and how much. So cases like Smith and McDonald that predate those rules really don't offer much guidance because they necessarily conflate the two issues because there was no rule separating them. Now we have the criminal rules separating very clearly that joinder, the initial joinder asks, you know, how similar or connected are these offenses? And then if the defendant feels he is prejudiced, severance is an issue that can be raised. 4.4 sets out specific requirements for preserving a severance claim or a claim that a joint trial is not proper. The importation of the prejudice analysis into 4.3 makes 4.4 superfluous. You no longer waive a severance claim because you can just bring the exact same claim under the joinder analysis, under Bryant, which is one of the main problems there. And as a practical matter, most initial joinders happen at the time of the initial filing, such as here where the state filed five of these robberies together. That was an initial joinder. When the court approves that filing, there's no defense counsel. The defendant may not even know he's being charged. There's no mechanism for any sort of prejudice analysis to happen at the stage of an initial joinder most of the time, which just is further evidence of why that is not a proper part of the analysis of the initial joinder. But even if this court chose to reach the prejudice question, either by reaching the severance claim or by following Bryant, in this case, the trial court properly exercised its discretion in finding that the defendant had failed to establish that a joint trial would be so manifestly prejudicial as to outweigh the concern for judicial economy. The factors that they have to look at in terms of the equal strength of evidence on each count, the clarity of defenses, and the instruction to compartmentalize, which was not appropriate here because the offenses were all cross-admissible, and most importantly, the finding on cross-admissibility was completely proper and not a manifest abuse of discretion. These cases, these incidents were incredibly similar, happening in similar situations. The defendant's actions followed the same pattern each time. The same types of property were taken. The same vehicle was involved. The same suspect descriptions or consistent suspect descriptions. Property from many of these offenses being found in the custody of the same people all created an absolutely overwhelming inference that the same person was responsible for all seven incidents, which was all that was required to then make their probative value so high that they were cross-admissible, even if the trials had been separated.
How do you distinguish it from, I think it's the Easterbrook case, where the court held there wasn't?
And I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not remembering the facts of Easterbrook off the top of my mind.
All right, the common factors in that case where the apartments were entered into were occupied by lone females who had been gone during the late evening. Clothing was disrupted in each apartment. Suspect had similar physical characteristics. Rapist wore a ring. Similar ring was found, et cetera. Ski mask. Lots of stuff, but not sufficiently unique.
I think part of the problem there is that the factors were not as unique. I mean, here, when you look at all of the combined factors, we also have not just here, it wasn't just the similarities among the incidents themselves, but the fact that the property was later then also all found in the custody of the same couple. I mean, there's just no way to get around the inference that the same people, whether it was Bluford or someone else connected with Brie Brazil, was responsible for all of these. And in fact, that was the defendant's defense at trial. He acknowledged the same person was involved in all of them. He just claimed it wasn't him. So for that reason, all of the facts here in totality make it a proper exercise of discretion. Thank you.
I'd like to turn back to the sentencing issues for a few minutes and hopefully get to the joinder issue at the end. Turning to the New Jersey robbery and why it's not comparable, looking at the charging document issue, we don't have the charging document to which he pled guilty. State's arguing, well, we can look to the record as a whole to somehow divine what he pled guilty to in the absence of that charging document. There's no case that says that. State doesn't cite to one. I haven't found any. When we're looking at legal comparability, we're looking at, okay, what's in the judgment and sentence documents? What's in the charging document in a plea case? Those are the things we look at. And when we're missing the charging document, that's a big problem. State says, well, we can look at the facts that were recited by the judge, not aligned facts of that case, acknowledging that that's not proper for factual comparability analysis, but somehow proper for the legal comparability analysis. But that doesn't make any sense, because when we're looking at why you can't rely on those unproven or unadmitted, unstipulated facts, the reason why you can't do that is because that's going to violate the right to the jury trial under the Sixth Amendment.
What do you think of the state's argument, which I think they summarized in the sentence, that every hope I can get this here. Every completed robbery in New Jersey is necessarily includes an attempted robbery in Washington. Did I say that right?
I think you did.
Okay.
I don't think much of that argument, though. And the reason why is because when we're looking at what's required, again, it's the mens rea problem. Mens rea is broader in New Jersey for the completed crime of robbery involving an attempted theft than it is for the Washington attempted robbery. It's because in Washington, the attempted robbery, as it is for any intent or attempt crime, is that there must be proven the intent to commit the specific crime, which means that, you know, for robbery, it requires the proof that there is intent to commit the taking of property of another by means of force. And that's different. That's narrower than, or rather, that's New Jersey is broader than Washington in that respect. And we look at State v. DeReich is a good case to analogize to, because that case involved an attempted crime of, in that case, it was first-degree attempted rape. Okay. And so the issue there was they were trying to figure out, okay, what's the intent requirement for the attempted rape in that context? You know, it's intent to commit the specific crime, but what precisely? And the court said, well, it's actually, in that case, the intent to commit rape by forcible compulsion. That's what made it first-degree attempted rape. Well, analogize to the situation of Bluford's case, where, okay, what's the intent for the attempted robbery here? What's the intent to commit the criminal result at issue? What's at issue is the intent to commit the taking of property of another by means of force. So that's the difference. Turning briefly to the joinder issue, Mr. Bluford asked this court to reach the merits of that issue, especially in light of the way this case or this issue was litigated below, where the two motions, the motion to join, the motion to sever, they're all mushed up together, and they weren't separated out. In fact, the state below actually cites State v. Bryant for the very proposition that Bluford is citing it for appeal, which is that, well, when you consider joinder, you have to consider these prejudice factors. And now the state on appeal has turned around and distanced itself from that position and tries to argue, well, let's get rid of Bryant and let's not even reach the merits. Based on the way this case was litigated below, this is not a good case to reach that issue. And instead, Mr. Bluford asked this court to reach the merits of the joinder issue and rule that the court abused its discretion in so joining those counts. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The